Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, and welcome to Ones and Twos, FP's economics podcast. Every week we take a couple data points, use them to try to explain the world. I'm Cameron Abadi, FP's deputy editor, with you in Berlin, Germany. Joining me here in Berlin this week is Adam Tooze, FP's economics columnist, Columbia University professor. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Cam.
Okay, so in the second half of this show, we're going to be talking about the economics of resort hotels. We're entering the resort hotel season, at least here in Europe, as Easter beckons on the horizon. But first, we wanted to end our series on long COVID, as we've called it, the after effects of the COVID pandemic. The data point we have there is 2%. That is the probability of a pandemic with similar impact to COVID happening in any given year. That's according to the National Academy of Sciences, a study that they published last year.
The head of the World Health Organization is urging countries to make changes and start preparing for the next global pandemic.
We need a plan for the second pandemic. There's going to be another pandemic. We have to think ahead.
That's a 1 in 50 chance, so you can do the math there. Many listeners are likely to experience another pandemic along these lines sometime during their lifetime. Obviously, our earlier segments on COVID these past few weeks have been about the ways that COVID has changed the world, both in specific ways, commercial real estate, in general terms, in terms of trends in the international economy. This week, we wanted to finish by talking about the ways things haven't changed, the ways we've repressed the pandemic since it occurred and ended. That seems to be also a trend across the world. So we wanted to sort of unpack why that's the case and whether we should be thinking about all this differently. So Adam, to start off, there's this term that I remember seeing applied to the pandemic. It's drawn from economics or statistics, a black swan event. That is applied to various types of crises, financial crises, but also this COVID pandemic. And I'm curious, what is the significance of that description as applied to a crisis in general? And does it properly apply to the pandemic we just had?
Yeah, it's a fascinating concept. It originates notionally in the ancients, who talked about the something being as unlikely as seeing a black swan, which to them meant that it would never occur until, of course, Europeans traveled to Australia and actually discovered black swans there as a fact. The idea was taken up more recently by the financial markets guru Nassim Taleb, who from 2001 onwards popularized the idea and then gave it additional impetus with the 2008 financial crisis. His version of the black swan theory has three crucial components. First, it's an outlier. So the event is an outlier. It lies outside the realm of regular expectation because nothing in the past can convincingly point to its possibility, hence the European idea about them being no such thing as black swans. Secondly, it carries an extreme impact, so it's an event that really matters, unlike swans, but in the case of pandemics, of course, they really do matter. And then the third element of the Taleb argument is that black swans are retrospectively constructed as inevitable or explicable or predictable, when in fact they're probably not. And so we kind of live in this cycle of self-deception. And I think on that basis, you have to say that the pandemic clearly isn't a black swan, in the sense that, as you say, we can in fact attach a meaningful probability to the chance of a pandemic. There have been decades of work in the development of new infectious diseases. The arrival of COVID was anything other really than surprising. Our failure to react to its arrival was, I think, the more surprising thing. If you're going to call this something, I think the grey rhino theory seems more applicable, with the grey rhino being the sort of thing you know is there and dangerous, but somehow blends in with the background long enough for you to end up believing that it's never going to happen. So this was this idea that Michel Bouquet made popular in a book which became a huge bestseller in China after Xi Jinping took up the idea of grey rhinos as the sort of risk the CCP regime needs to hedge against. And I think that's a much better description, broadly speaking, as you say. If, you know, with independent probabilities in any one year, the chance of a pandemic happens is independent of the chance of the likelihood of it happening in the current year. But if you imagine yourself living over a period of decades and ask yourself, how long will it be before it becomes really quite likely that you have experienced one, only a couple of decades of life will put you in the zone where you really have to expect to experience a pandemic. That is, I think, the nature of the beast. And those probabilities are almost certainly rising over time because we have good reason to believe that zoonotic mutation, animal-human interaction is the main driver of the emergence of infectious diseases. And that is getting more and more intense with time. So not a black swan, a gray rhino.
Okay, so we do have these probabilities. So this is not a black swan event. So can we say that we're now prepared for the next pandemic? Have we put systems in place since the last pandemic to respond to the next one?
I mean, I think hospitals, public health systems are more aware of the risks than they were in the past, and that's a bonus. But I mean, broadly speaking, what the pandemic taught us is it's all about vaccines. It was once we had vaccines in the pipeline and being produced that we had some hope of escaping the crisis. And it was an absolutely record performance. Early stage crude vaccines were available in China within months. The most sophisticated vaccines were available within 326 days of the genomic sequence being published, and 13 billion doses of COVID vaccine and counting were administered. And that's really the triumph. And so I think all of the questions have got to be about vaccine development going forward. And the rates of return on the vaccine are absolutely staggering. We think it halved mortality. We would probably have had 14 to 20 million extra deaths if the vaccine hadn't arrived. If you break that down and all of the attendant and collateral effects of shutdowns and so on for the city of New York, for instance, a rate of return was estimated that it varies somewhere between 4 to 1. So every dollar spent yields $4 in terms of overall benefit, to as much as $10 for every dollar spent. So I think all of the focus has got to be on that. And governments around the world, to their credit, have recognized this. So in 2022, the British government convened a major meeting where they agreed that the target would be able to produce a vaccine within 100 days. I think the question's got to be whether or not the sustained spending is generated that's necessary. And the really puzzling thing is that the levels of spending required to equip us with a suite of vaccines necessary to meet what the WHO, for instance, identifies as the 12 top threats is modest, right? It's about $3 billion per disease virus to actually develop an effective vaccine response. That's sort of the estimate that policymakers work on. So, you know, you can easily do the math. $50 billion buys you a head start on vaccine development for the key diseases which the WHO identifies as major threats. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that level of commitment around the world right now. So I think the answer to your question is that we have a pretty good idea of what it takes to produce a response. The policymakers understand it, but as so often in the current moment, all of that enlightenment and insight and clarity of purpose doesn't actually translate into the kind of levels of spending, even though the kind of levels of spending that are necessary and not heroic. And even though the rates of return on these investments are gigantic, whichever disease you look at, the cost of developing the vaccine, even if you regard it, to me, not obvious we should regard it as a cost, because what we're actually talking about is building labs and training folks to be molecular biologists and lab technicians, which we should, broadly speaking, regard as the most valuable or one of the most valuable sorts of pursuits that people could be engaged in. So we should really be thinking of it as investment or, you know, something like that rather than a cost. In any case, despite all of this abundant logic, we're not actually, I think, seeing the scale of push you would expect. We spend a lot of time instead talking about NATO 2% GDP commitments and things like that, as though those were better guarantees of security. Whereas Germany's defense budget by itself, even in its current level, which is widely considered to be inadequate, would be enough. The 50 billion euros or so they spend would be enough to actually make a down payment on the key vaccine development for all of the WHO suite. And, well, you know, you've got to ask yourself, where would Germany's taxpayer euros be better invested, in some, you know, lamentably inadequate military or in a world-class biohazard preparation.
I mean, just to clarify here, is this not something that the private sector can sort of carry on its own? I mean, clearly these private companies that had the vaccine breakthroughs had huge windfalls. I mean, can the kind of private sector do the calculations and sort of have some sort of venture capital, like kind of some, make some bets on future pandemics in that way?
We haven't seen that imagination there, and for obvious reasons. A lot of the diseases that one will be wanting to develop the vaccines for, of diseases above all of poverty, so the big markets aren't there. The way in which they made their money was selling vaccines early to rich countries. The global vaccine effort relied almost entirely on India. And I think the most promising development, one of the more promising developments, is a push to roll out vaccine production capacity for Africa so that each major mega region can become largely self-sufficient in vaccine. That's the way to go. In the current mood, of course, in the current world, all of the global conversation about vaccine development involves various ideas of public-private partnership. And it's hard to argue with the success of that model during COVID. But again, it's just it's as often with these de-risking models, how much public spending, how much are we willing to pony up and commit to the de-risking that will be necessary? On the whole, vaccines are not, you know, it's not where the pharmaceutical industry really likes to earn its money. You're better off in weight loss drugs or, you know, the treatment of chronic disease in extremely rich and rather old Europeans and Americans.
Yeah, I can recommend people check out our segment on Ozempic and the Danish economy if you're interested in that. But I guess I wanted to ask, beyond preparing for the next pandemic in these specific ways, you know, in terms of beefing up our vaccine capabilities, there was a lot of talk during the pandemic, you know, across sectors about the opportunity that the pandemic offered to fundamentally rethink and reorder our economy and politics. You know, there were all sorts of discussions about just kind of blue sky thinking about how we would never think about society the same way. And, you know, as I suggested, it seems like we've moved on without doing any of that reordering that we imagined. So, I mean, what is the failure of that to happen? Tell us about how fundamental change really, really happens in society. I mean, has our ability to respond to crisis, to palliate crises, you know, we did a pretty good job of that, I guess, all things considered during the pandemic. Have we gotten so good at that that it's basically forestalled more fundamental political changes that we also kind of at least considered?
Well, I think the enthusiasm with which the call for, you know, there was those famous calls for a new social contract and so on was taken up in 2020, does tell us something about the fragile, shall we say, legitimacy of the status quo. Given that shock, there was a willingness to say we should really rethink the priorities. And what specifically was it that we were thinking about? We were thinking about social hierarchy, the relevance of care, the significance of the infrastructure of human services, delivery services, and so on that sustain urban life for so many people, and was a desire to revalue those and upgrade those. And there isn't much, very little of that has actually materialized in a serious way. In the US case, Build Back Better, the elaborate left version of Biden's economic policy, might have incorporated some of those ideas, but it was killed in the congressional negotiations that ultimately led to the Inflation Reduction Act, which came out as a very kind of hard hat classic industrial policy proposal instead. So I think it's true to say that those major desires for a fundamental shift didn't transpire. And so then I think the next question to ask oneself is, so under what circumstances could one imagine a shift? So if you imagine the virus had been much worse, more like the Spanish flu, and had been killing children, for instance, on a huge scale, and on the other hand, we had not come up with a vaccine, it seems to me that then we probably would be looking at quite a transformed social reality. It's difficult to imagine that not being a transformed situation, because we really then would be reliant on healthcare services in a way that is even more drastic than what actually transpired. And we would be needing to rethink the entire balance between home and work life, because children would be furloughed from school and so on. So if we had like a Spanish flu style pandemic, I think it quite likely would have transformed social relations in quite a profound way, given the modern assumptions. I don't think we would have worked our way through it in the way that folks did 100 years ago, because as there isn't very much sign of a social transformation from that shock, even though it was an order of magnitude worse in terms of mortality. So there's something about the current moment in which the relative moderation of the COVID shock, and then, yes, as you were saying, our success in finding a vaccine that contained this transformative process. And of course, not all technological solutions do that. Some technological solutions have consequences which are quite dramatic if you think about various phases of industrialization or ultimately information technology on which our continuation of daily life so heavily depended during COVID. But there's something about vaccines, I think, that make them kind of like a status quo technology. They're like, take this thing in your arm, doesn't cost very much to actually produce it, it's a cheap fix that enables us to simply ignore this threat, to deny it, to move on through. So I don't think it's generally true that the COVID crisis demonstrates that massive social change in the modern era is impossible. I think what it is telling us is that it'll need a bigger pandemic, a more dangerous pandemic, and one for which we don't find a vaccine-style solution that is a shot in the arm. That then literally, I mean, most of us remember this incredible feeling once you had the vaccine of just sort of returning to your ordinary life in this sudden way. And it's easy to imagine, I think, shocks which don't so readily permit that kind of return of the status quo. I think there may therefore have been, as it were, a projection of desires for fundamental change onto an event which wasn't severe enough at one hand, and on the other hand, had a technological solution that means that this may not be a true guide to what lies in the future. I mean, we cannot, of course, no one in their right mind would wish a more lethal pandemic so as to produce more dramatic social change. That's a horrible fantasy.
That's fascinating that this was not a legitimacy crisis. For as bad as it was not a legitimacy crisis, I guess, because of the technological advance.
Well, I think if you imagine the U.S. situation of 2020 continuing for longer, if the Trump administration's misrule had continued for longer and they hadn't been saved by the vaccine, who knows? I think all bets would be off. And that's even at the level of lethality that COVID developed in the U.S., which was severe, but an order of magnitude different than the Spanish flu. So there was a legitimacy crisis, but it was one that was ultimately contained. And then, as you said, other measures, so for instance, the economic measures that we talked about earlier in this series were very spectacularly effective. So the disposable income of Americans went up, despite mass unemployment. The Europeans demonstrated that you didn't need to experience the insecurity of involuntary unemployment. The biggest shocks, as we were saying also earlier in the series, are to lower income and emerging market economies. There, I think, the questions are more open as to what the longer term effect will be. I think we're going to see that going down the line.
Yeah, well, I guess technocracy worked in some ways, but perhaps not in others. And one can imagine how this provides an analogy for how some people are hoping climate change will be fixed with some kind of technological fix that then will not lead to a kind of broader, more fundamental crisis. But obviously, that's a different topic. I guess I wanted to ask finally, I mean, in general, it does seem to me there's another dynamic at work here, which is a kind of amnesia about the pandemic. I mean, in general, it seems obvious that we don't talk about the pandemic as much as one would expect. And it does also seem that some actively encourage us to forget about it. Actually, you know, in the most farcical way, the Republicans right now in the United States, Donald Trump's campaign is asking Americans seemingly seriously whether they think they're better off than they were 4 years ago. Obviously, 4 years ago was in the middle of the pandemic. But the assumption is that almost that people won't remember that. To me, it seems like there's some kind of repression, psychological repression at work. Perhaps that's itself caused by trauma. And I'm curious, in economic history, is there a distinct role that psychological trauma can be said to play in the economy?
Yeah, I think it's just a very interesting question. And I kind of took it in a slightly lateral way. So I was trying to think, you know, in which society could we look to see where like mass trauma was really effective and what damage it has done economically. And you think about, you know, post-war Western Europe or Japan, And these are sort of simple stories of success in the end. So they're perhaps not all that interesting. So then I unearthed a set of studies about Cambodia, you know, which is a society which obviously suffered a genocidal trauma in the 1970s. Population fell from 7 million that had survived the Vietnam War to 5 million that survived the horror of the Pol Pot regime. So 2 million people were killed in the period between 75 and 79. And there has in fact been a series of quite serious economic studies and social psychological studies about the impact of this on Cambodian society. One group of researchers went out to see whether they could isolate the mental health effects, because you would expect that very large parts of the society are suffering from massive trauma, you know, perhaps analogous in some ways to the, you know, the Holocaust, post-Holocaust, the survivor populations in cities like New York in the 50s and 60s. And this would translate intergenerationally as well. And if you spent any time in Cambodia and had the chance to talk to Cambodians, practically everyone you meet can tell you a story about this. What they found, the psychologists found, was that they couldn't find a strong link to historic trauma. What they did find was that current mental health problems had a major impact on economic prosperity in Cambodia, and those two were linked in a circular way to poverty. And then another group of studies were done from a more economic side that isolated longer-term effects. So they literally looked at villages that were closer to mass graves than those which were further away from mass graves, and tried to see whether the persistent effects, and there are indeed persistent effects. So the closer you are to a mass grave from the killing fields, the lower your GDP decades later in Cambodia. But they argue that this isn't to do with psychological trauma, it's to do with the destruction of the educated population, because the Pol Pot regime targeted people with glasses, people who had education of any type, and people who could read. So I think the majority of the evidence from a society as starkly impacted by traumatic horror and violence as Cambodia is that it isn't the psychological trauma inherited that's doing the damage so much as real impacts, notably on human capital, which then in turn create poverty, which creates stress, which creates mental illness. And that, you might say, is also, I think, having done the research for this series, the single most dramatic conclusion of all of the studies that we've looked at, is that the loss of human capital to the school children, especially the lower income world, but also lower income families in the advanced economies, is really the longer term damage that we need to focus on the social side. And that will quite likely in due course manifest itself as various types of depression, frustration, mental health issues. We already know there is a global epidemic, crisis of mental health that was triggered by the pandemic. But it'll be by way of the material impact on people's education, on their ability to actually thrive and prosper, and thereby digest the consequences of the shock that damage will make itself felt.
Yeah, obviously, you know, addressing that crisis is a precondition of that is acknowledging the problem. And yeah, often it sounds like people aren't willing to do that right now in the case of the pandemic. But yeah, one can also imagine how that applies to other crises as well. We do need to leave this conversation here for now. That would be the end of our series on COVID. Thanks for listening through all four parts. We'll take a break here and be back in a second to talk about a very different but perhaps related topic, hotel resorts.
Hi, ones and twos listeners, Rob Sachs here. I'm one of the show's producers, and I'm here to tell you a little bit more about one of our sponsors, BetterHelp. So springtime is here, and if you're like me, you're ready to get out and hang out with some friends and family a little bit more. But sometimes going out can get a bit overwhelming, especially if your social battery is feeling drained. If this is the case, therapy can be a great way to help keep your social battery well charged. Having someone who can assess your concerns and give you perspective can make all the difference in the world and give the boost you need to feel mentally prepared to go out and be your best self. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you gotta do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched up with a licensed therapist, and you can swap therapists at any time for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/onestwos, that's T-O-O-Z-E twos, today to get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/onestwos.
Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, welcome back. Our next data point is $7.9 billion. That is the total amount of sales conducted by resort hotels. That was in the year 2019. So, you know, give or take, that's a ballpark figure maybe for how resort hotels do around the world. Relevant topic in general because we're right on the precipice of the Easter holiday when many families go on vacation, and I am included among them. I've gone on vacations with my family and two young kids before. I've tried different types of vacations, and finally I've thrown my hands up in the air and decided together with my wife this year to go to a resort on the coast of Turkey. It's one of these all-inclusive package deals. We land, they bring us to a hotel, food, drinks, entertainment for the kids. Yeah, compared with kind of trudging around a city with two young kids, it seemed like a relief, but it'll be new. We'll see how it goes. I've never done it before. But we thought we could discuss the economics behind this whole concept, because clearly I'm not alone in visiting these places. So yeah, to start off, Adam, I thought I would just ask for a kind of potted history of resort hotels, if you can offer one.
Yeah, it's an ancient history. It's funny listening to you, Kevin. the tone of a vaguely apologetic tone. Yeah,
well, there's an aesthetic issue here.
You feel like you've surrendered. But as once upon a time the parent of a young child, I can only say it's heaven on earth, and you will not regret it. If you can afford it, it's definitely a great option for young families. And we, you know, it isn't just modern people who realize this. So, I mean, I think there's like three convergent strands, if I may not be too serious about this issue, in the history of the modern resort. I mean, one is the very idea of seaside living, which goes all the way back to the Romans. So much of this in Europe traces back to the Romans, who had resort towns all along the coast of what is now modern Italy. And those then really disappeared with the collapse of the Roman Empire. But from the 18th century onwards, if not before, Europeans were visiting the seaside, notably in Britain, then also in Germany. Heiligendamm in Mecklenburg was the first German resort on the Baltic. By the 19th century, with railways, you had a lot of seaside resorts that were easily accessible by train from the city. And by the 1930s, you had regular paid holidays, which enabled people to go to the seaside. There's actually an extraordinary film on YouTube about the first cohort of French people who from Paris took the train to the Normandy Atlantic coast and bathed during the 36 Popular Front government when they had their first paid week of vacation. So that's one strand. The other strand is the spa, which also has Roman origins. And we call it spa because the Romans had a baths complex, a curative bathing complex in what is now the Belgian town of Spa. And so in that hilly landscape with natural mineral springs, the Romans already developed a culture of bathing. This wasn't confined to the Roman Empire. The Egyptians, many of the Mediterranean cultures had elaborate bathing cultures, as do non-European and many other Eurasian cultures. But if we're actually fast-forwarding to the present and asking ourselves when does the modern all-inclusive resort come into existence, it's again in Britain, the most developed of the European countries in the 1930s in the legendary Butlins holiday camps, and then from the 1950s, Club Med. And it's really Club Med which from 1950 onwards found the modern concept of the all-inclusive, you know, party-focused resort, enclosed resort.
That's a French company, yeah?
It's a classically Euro company, but it's a French company, yeah.
So I guess I'm curious how the business model of this modern resort that you're describing works exactly. It seems to be structured by this all-inclusive concept. And I'm, you know, curious how that works for both sides of the transaction exactly. I mean, it strikes me that customers, again, I'm among them, you know, the upside is you don't have to wonder about the final costs involved in making this kind of trip. But from the resort side, I imagine then from the business model, there are advantages as well in relying on cross subsidies, I suppose, you know, with kids maybe not consuming as much as adults or some adults consuming less than others, et cetera. And I guess maybe there's advantages in planning as well. So, yeah, I mean, how does the business model work exactly?
It addresses what business economists or microeconomists refer to as the hold-up problem. And the hold-up problem is fairly familiar from lots of different settings, I mean, from all sorts of settings, commercial and uncommercial, which is the problem of your reluctance to enter into a contract when you don't know whether one party to the contract will subsequently revise the terms of the deal in a very unfavorable way. So basically, the fear is of the, you know, anxious parent that you sign up to go to this resort. You're in a food desert, shops are miles away, and they'll gouge you when you get there because the restaurants will be too expensive. Spend a lot of time in airports. This is the American airport business model. Not true in Europe, right? So in Europe, they in fact resolve this problem by saying our promise is in British airports that nothing will cost more than it does in the high street. So come and do your shopping in the airport. Whereas you'd have to be a fool to buy anything in an American airport because they resort to this primitive hold-up type thing. You're there, you can't escape. We can charge you $25 for a sandwich if we like. So that's the all-inclusive model is eliminates the hold-up problem. And what it says is we will get more bargains, more people will agree, more deals, more people will agree to go on holidays than they would if they didn't have this promise. If they don't have this promise, people will retreat from the idea of going to a enclosed a resort because they just don't know what the price terms will be. If you promise them a fixed price, more people will actually sign up to go. So in the end, you get more business, more activity, more sales, which is also why you get much bigger brand names in European airports than you do in American airports, because in the European model is just increase the volume of sales at this particular point at your standard price. Don't try and, as it were, make super profit by charging anything you like through the hold-up situation. And indeed, once you get people there, the model is exactly the cross-subsidization thing that you pointed to. And resorts have demonstrated that it is significantly more profitable. And some of the stuff I've seen online suggests that the profit margins are almost twice as high for the all-inclusive deal. So in the end, the consumer is paying for the security of knowing that they're not going to be gouged by being gouged, but not being gouged to the same extent, right? And certain consumers who know that they're going to be heavy users of the benefits happily sign up and enjoy. So it's an interesting model, but it does seem to work in encouraging people to go on holiday, take the package, and then have a relaxed time. One of the reasons the resorts like it is that the payment is all up front. So they receive a cash payment, a large lump payment, and then their relationship with their customers is unaffected by any kind of transaction. So it creates goodwill. Once you're there, you just feel basically they're extremely generous because the original payment was made beforehand.
I mean, what can we say about the effect on the communities that these resorts are situated in? Does that have an economic effect on the general area they are placed in?
And well, the advocates of the model would say that because you get bigger business, in the end, there's more jobs created by this kind of model. And there are hundreds of all-inclusive resorts. I think one figure I saw said there are about 860 all-inclusive resorts all over the world, and about half of them are in the Caribbean. And so the advocates of the model would say it's a tourism generating business. the critics would say, first of all, why is it that in a situation like the Caribbean, you do this enclosure? Part of it is basically pandering to a bunch of racist or racialized stereotypes about people needing a comfort zone, not wanting to be distracted, quote unquote, by the particularities of the local region and just wanting to enjoy the paradise of the beautiful water and needing this enclosed bubble in which to do that. So from a cultural and political point of view, they are an extraordinarily kind of colonial, you could say, kind of model of vacationing. And in economic terms, the consequences of that can be very severe in that for some of the resort systems in the Caribbean, it's estimated only about 20 to 30% of the revenue generated by the resort stays locally in the form of wages and local supplies. And the vast majority of the revenue generated flows back out again in forms of dividend payments and flown-in supplies that create this bubble of essentially a North American existence or a European existence in a physical geography that is someone else's or some other place. And the cruise ship that you invoked is the extreme case of that, right? Because there's virtually no local labor either. You basically just have maybe guides or bus drivers that ship the people around. They arrive in a town, if you've been in Puerto Rico or somewhere like that, in San Juan, when a big ship comes in, you get this huge surge of sort of tourist trinket purchasing, a little bit of daytime dining, and then everyone leaves. There's no hotel rooms booked. There's no longer term in labor. You just get back on the ship and leave. So those have, it's called leakage in the tourist economics jargon. They have maximum leakage, minimum retention of revenue within the local community. It's a very ambiguous model, I think, of development. The obvious solution is actually just to insist on localizing as much as possible to attract local investment and to build supply chains, which actually rely heavily on local economies. Because clearly, you know, a resort operating in the Caribbean produces a different input-output matrix than one operating in Greece or Spain. Or Britain, or, you know, a luxury spa resort somewhere where essentially almost all of the revenue flows back into the local community because it's all sourced locally.
I mean, you evoked the colonial metaphor here. And I mean, it does strike me that in the people visiting these resorts in places like Turkey and the Caribbean tend to be Americans and Europeans. And I guess I wonder, yeah, whether the concept of a vacation of this sort is itself a kind of inherently Western one.
Well, it may have been historically. It no longer is. It's a hugely popular global model of tourism. So I was looking at figures for the Chinese resort business, and it's gigantic, as you would expect. I mean, it's huge. So Macau, which is the great Asian gambling center, and if you look at the origin of the 30 million people that visit Macau, 90% are from Asia, and 85% of those are from Hong Kong and mainland China. And that's 30 million visitors. Vegas gets 40 million visitors a year. So Macau is just 10 million short of Vegas. Mexico's tourism complex, the whole Mexican tourism complex generates 66 million visitors. The Chinese tropical island of Hainan has 99 million visitors a year. So Hainan as a tourism complex, everything's bigger in China. It's just bigger.
Do we know the composition of visitors? Are they
primarily
Chinese?
It's all Chinese. That's entirely mainland Chinese. Yeah, I mean, you know, 99%, yeah. Right? China is, and Chinese visitors are the big drivers of global tourism, global luxury consumption. It's just a numbers game. And the Chinese middle class is so large. It may once have been a kind of European colonial thing, but
it's good to know.
Yeah, sort of, China does colonialism too.
To the extent that this exploitation exists, it's nice to know it's equal opportunity around the world. It's a kind of universal exploitation.
If you go look at Chinese build sites, Chinese construction sites, they bring their own cooks, they bring their own infrastructure. They encapsulate to every bit as much.
There you go. Well, this is definitely food for thought. I think I'm going to make my kids listen to this episode before we go.
I'm sorry, kids.
Lessons.
It's your dad's fault.
colonialism that we're engaging in next week. Okay, well.
Where are you actually going?
We're going to Antalya.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, on the coast of Turkey.
Turks can handle you, don't worry.
No. I'm also going to try to sneak out to see some ancient Greek sites, I hope, but or I'll just be locked into the resort itself. We'll see how it works, but I'll report back. Okay, we'll end here for now. Ones and Twos is written and edited by me, Cameron Abadi, along with Adam Twos. It's produced by Claudia Tatey, Laura Rossbrow-Tellum, Rob Sachs, and Dan Efron. This show is made possible through the support of Foreign Policy readers. If you're interested in news and analysis from around the world, consider subscribing. Listeners to Ones and Twos even get a 15% discount. Just go to foreignpolicy.com/subscribe and use the promo code TWOS at checkout. That's T-O-O-Z-E. And listeners, as always, we love getting your feedback. You can leave voice messages on the Ones and Twos homepage on foreignpolicy.com or email us, podcast@foreignpolicy.com, or you can tweet us. That's @onesandtwospod. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back in your feed next week.
The first teller of my story is me.
This week on Disorder.
In this new world, when military power will be connected with high tech, small states can be very, very powerful.
Could small states help order the world?
Small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones.
To find out, we're joined by Dr. Armen Sarkisian, Armenia's former president and prime minister.
In our two-part series, we discuss the history of the Armenian genocide,
the ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh,
and why small states could be the answer to the disorder in our world.
The big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
You can get Disorder wherever you get your podcasts, or you can follow the link in the show notes.